Elaine Beale is a local girl made good. Born and raised in Northern England, Elaine has lived in Oakland for over 20 years. I met her many years ago when she was a fundraiser for San Francisco Women Against Rape. At Women Against Rape, she co-founded Fearless Words, a writing workshop for survivors of sexual violence. A year and a half ago, I had the good fortune to enroll in one of her writing workshops at the Berkeley Writing Salon. In 2007, Elaine won the prestigious Poets and Writers California Exchange Contest, and out of that, she sold her first literary novel, Another Life Altogether, to an imprint of Random House. Her first novel, Murder in the Castro, was published in 1997. Another Life Altogether was released early this year to rave reviews and was picked as one of the 10 books to watch for in March by Oprah Magazine. Another Life is the story of a young lesbian in Northern England coming to terms with her own sexuality while dealing with her mother's mental illness. I asked Elaine how this novel differs from other coming out and coming of age stories.
To me, the main story in this is the relationship between the mother and the girl. And so Jessie's mother, who suffers from a mental illness, that relationship there, I think, is definitely the primary one. And, you know, for her, I think part of the journey in the novel is about her overcoming a lot of different aspects of shame. And the primary shame for her, I think, is that her mother is not the mother that she wants her to be. I mean, I also think, you know, I have not read any other book about the place that I grew up. You know, there are very few books that are written about East Yorkshire. For me, I think it was definitely about setting it in that place and that culture and that time that makes it somewhat different as well. And I think also the story is really connected to the landscape.
So can you talk about that place a bit? Because it's true. When I read the first pages and it mentioned Hull as the city where she lives, and I had never heard of that city. And then in reading your bio, I see that that is actually a place where you grew up.
Hull is actually one of the major ports, one of the largest ports in Britain. It's on the River Humber, and it's a city, currently it's actually a city of about 250,000 people. It's actually shrunk a lot with the economic decline in the north of England over the last few decades. And it used to be the country's major fishing port as well, and the fishing industry is basically dead in Britain, so the deep sea fishing industry. So it's on the east coast of northern England. Jessie begins the story in Hull, which is the major city of that area, but then she moves out to the countryside, and rural East Yorkshire is very different from the moors that you might imagine in Wuthering Heights or, you know, the Yorkshire Dales. People always tell me, you know, they've seen James Herriot on the television and they think that that's the area of the country. And East Yorkshire is not like that at all. It's actually incredibly flat. It's not particularly scenic, although there's some parts of the coast that are really, really quite pretty. And, you know, a significant aspect of the environment for Jessie is the fact that, first of all, it's flat and nothing really happens there. And secondly, that it has the fastest eroding coastline in Europe. You know, there wasn't a lot of excitement where I grew up in the area, but one of the exciting things was that large pieces of the coast would drop off. And so, you know, we'd go to the seaside and we'd see, you know, where there had been cliffs, there would no longer be cliffs. You could actually buy houses very, very cheap because they had, you know, a few yards of between them and the cliffside. And those houses, which, you know, would have been cheap when I was a kid, are no longer there and they're in the sea.
Talk about the character of Jessie.
Jessie is in some ways a lot like myself in that, you know, a lot of her escape is through books. When her mother goes to is sent to a mental institution, she actually makes up a story and tells everybody that her mother's gone on a trip around the world because she's won a competition on the back of a cornflakes packet. And Jessie writes letters from her mother to herself and begins to sort of discover this outside world beyond the very dull and boring and eroding world that she experiences. So she's seeking escape through books and through her imagination, but more than anything, she desperately wants to fit in. You know, she's a character where this is impossible for her, given the culture that she's growing up in. That part of the country, at least when I was younger, was a very insular part of the country. Despite the fact that Hull's a very large port, it's actually a very kind of isolated geographical part of the country, and people are even more narrow-minded there than they are in a lot of other parts of England, and definitely at that time. So she's facing a lot of prejudice and narrow-mindedness, and at the same time is really aware of the fact that she's different, and she doesn't want to be different, and she doesn't want to be different in many different respects. And, you know, for all of us, of course, who've been through adolescence, I think that that is one of the real struggles for us. You know, we need to find a peer group, someone who's going to, you know, people who are going to accept us, and that seems really impossible for her at that time.
So talk about your own background.
All my parents' families were at least one generation back from Hull. My dad's family was actually involved in the fishing industry. My mom was a nurse, actually, which was very unusual at that time for, well, it wasn't unusual for women to be nurses, but it was unusual among the women that I knew in my family. You know, I come from a working class family. If the women did work, they had jobs like cashier in a supermarket or, you know, cleaning other people's houses and stuff like that. And my mom actually had, you know, what I guess could be regarded as a career at that point, and was a really big deal. I didn't learn this till after she died, actually, that it was a really big deal for her. And I think it was a real source of pride for her. And my dad worked in an office. He was kind of like a lowly office guy, basically. But on both sides of my family, there was a lot of involvement in the sea.
What do you see as the role of the writer in our society?
I think first, and you know, I'm talking about fiction writing now. I have to say, I think the first role of a writer is to entertain. And by that, I don't mean on a superficial level, but I really do mean, you know, to let people go somewhere different, to take and to remove them from the life that they're in now. Now, you can do that in a way that really is about purely entertainment. But you can do that. You can also do that in a way which allows people to access deeper truths, I think, too.
I was looking at an interview you did and looking at the list of novels that you sort of are among your favorites. And I was really happy to see Crows Over a Wheat Field on your list.
Oh, I love that book, yes.
Which I just adored. And it's, to me, like really a feminist classic. And yet very few people have read it or I think know about it. It's by Paula Sharp.
I think that book was pretty close to genius, I think. And it deals with so many complex issues with characters who are so convincing. And you're right, it did not get the level of attention that I think that book and she deserves. I mean, she's an extraordinarily gifted writer, and that is an extraordinary book. And it's one of those books that I would, you know, I always recommend to people. I'm like, you have to read this book. And 99 times out of 100, no one has heard of it or heard of her.
Whenever I go to see a movie and I'm like, why did they make that movie? There are so many great stories out there to make movies out of, and they're just like making remakes. Whenever I think about books that I've read that would make great movies, that is always the first one that comes to mind. And I can't believe that nobody did it.
I think because of its underlying, it's definitely not a dogmatic book in any sense, but I think it really deals with some very real issues about the legal system, domestic violence, mental illness. It's a very complex book. Maybe it's too complex, I don't know. But also, you know, I mean, it has has lead female characters. 25% of roles go to female actors in Hollywood, you know. So, you know, I saw Up recently, which I actually think is I really liked a lot of that movie. But the only female character in that movie dies within the first 10, 15 minutes. It just drives me crazy. You know, I do want to make a plug for a great, you know, somewhat mainstream movie that, again, I didn't think got a lot of attention with two really strong female leads, which is Frozen River. And I forget her name now, but the main actress in that got nominated for Melissa
Leo. Yeah, Melissa Leo.
She's brilliant.
A favorite.
She was wonderful in that movie. Yeah. And again, but, you know, it's so unusual to see a movie with two women characters. I mean, what else can we, you know, that are leads?
So I read in an interview that you write at a treadmill desk. What is that?
I had a lot of back problems because I was sitting so much. And then I found out about this guy, like this author who was using a treadmill desk. And I went online and he has a website. And he was basically, what it is you stand at a treadmill and you run it no more than a mile an hour and you write while you're walking very, very slowly. You know, you can buy them for like $5,000. I actually put mine together, you know, using bits of string and, nothing fancy. You know, I kind of strapped on some planks onto a regular treadmill and hung a monitor on the wall. And so I do that. I don't do it all day, but I do it a couple of hours of the day. And I don't have any back pain.
Something else that I read in that same interview was they asked you what the first book you remember reading is, and you said Ginger's Adventures, which is a book I had not heard about. You said it's a story told in rhyme about a puppy, and you said that you can still recite the first verse. So I have to ask you to do that.
Oh, no. Okay. Ginger's bedroom was a kennel in the garden by the wall, where he often lay a-dozing, waiting for his friend to call. Yeah.
Talk about what you're working on now.
Well, I'm actually working on a young adult fantasy. I decided that I wanted to write, because although Another Life Altogether, I like to think it has aspects of humor in it. It was, you know, it's hard to go back and be a 13-year-old again, which is what you have to do when you write a 13-year-old protagonist. You know, there are definitely parts of that book that were unpleasant to write, you know, and sit and be with emotionally, as because that's what you have to do with your characters. And after I wrote that book, I actually wrote a memoir that is in a draft form right now, but it was about my mother's death. And I said, you know, I just want to write something fun. So I'm writing this book that I'm hoping is funny, and it's written for, like, you know, 10-year-olds. So, of course, humor for 10-year-olds is often very silly and very physical and very, you know, based on a lot of misunderstandings and misinterpretations. But it's set in England, and it's basically about a druid gone bad.
So talk about your role as a teacher. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would say, I mean, it's sort of a cliche, oh, you can't teach writing, but that's what you do. What do you try to convey to people who come to mm-hmm. your classes and want to write?
You know, one of the things I really like about the teaching that I do is that the people who come to my classes tend to be really of really diverse ages. And so, you know, anyone from 20s to, actually one of my regular students right now is over 70. And I particularly enjoy working with people who are older because they've often come to writing later in their lives. And they come to it with a lot of wisdom and experience and understanding, which is, which I really enjoy. But I think oftentimes what people come to it later with also is a lack of confidence in their own voices. And, you know, I think we often have a belief that you're either a writer or you're not. You know, it takes talent and hard work to succeed as a writer, but it really also takes a very, very strong belief in yourself and your voice and the importance of the stories that you have to tell. And so one of the things I really see as my essential role is to let people know that their stories are important. It's important to do creative writing, not necessarily to be published, although being published is a great and wonderful thing. But the process in and of itself is an important thing. You know, and I feel like it's empowering a lot of different ways. We live in a culture that's very, you know, we're supposed to be consumers. We're supposed to be passive. You know, if you look at what people did a couple of hundred years ago in Europe, for example, or in this country, or in indigenous cultures, you know, what they still do until it's been wiped out, you know, is storytelling. And people would engage in that, and it wouldn't be a passive activity, it would be an active community activity. So one of the things I really try and encourage people to do is to tell their stories. I'm like a coach, I'm like a little cheerleader in that respect, you know. And then secondly, if you want to tell stories and you want people to listen to them and pay attention to them, you have to learn to write well. That's a skill. Of course, some of us have a more inherent talent for it than others, like everything. But I also believe that it's a really concrete skill that you can learn. And, you know, so the essential things like, you know, one of the mantras of fiction is show, don't tell, show, don't tell. And so one of the things that I often find myself talking to about people is how to show something rather than explain or give something an exposition. You can help people write more effective sentences. You can help people figure out how to describe things better. You can help people figure out how to develop characters. But essentially, if folks don't believe that their stories are worth telling, then they won't do it. And that's why I like to teach in the community rather than in the academy, because I think in the academy, there's more a sense of, you know, it's all about craft. And yeah, it's just different. And I really enjoy it. I love it. You know, it's kind of this feeling of having an exponential impact. If you get people to write their stories, to find their voices and say what it is that they want to say, we contribute to this immense dialogue of art in the world. And art is so important.
So do you want to read something?
Sure. So I'm going to read from chapter 2. Jessie is the 13-year-old protagonist who her mother has been sent to a mental hospital, and the name of the mental hospital is Delapol in Hull. And her mother has recently returned now, and her father has decided that they should move because he wants to get them out into the countryside where the neighbors won't be poking their noses in their business anymore. The week after my father decided to move, Auntie Mabel came round to help us pack. My mother's older sister, she always arrived in a cloud of cigarette smoke and thick, flowery perfume, smells that lingered in the house long after she left. Mabel was an Avon lady, and she carried one of the catalogues with her wherever she went, whipping it out of her massive PVC handbag whenever the opportunity to make a pitch for her products arose. She hosted Tupperware parties as well, and she seemed convinced that all my mother needed was a little makeup and a few fully sealable sandwich containers to set her all to rights.
"You should come over to our house next Saturday," Mabel said, flicking the ash of her cigarette with a glossy red fingernail filed to a hazardous point.
She and my mother had spent 20 minutes half-heartedly tossing items into boxes when Mabel decided that it was time to retreat to the kitchen for a cup of tea. I'd been told to keep on wrapping my mother's best glasses in old copies of the Daily Mail. But after a few minutes, I got bored and followed them. Mabel had taken off her shoes and had her feet up on one of the chairs. She was wiggling her stocking-covered toes and blowing long puffs of cigarette smoke into the air. My mother sat hunched over the table, her teacup nestled in both hands.
"We're going to have cheese sticks and some of those little hot dog sausages," Mabel continued. "And I'm going to do a makeup demo on the woman who lives next door. Oh, you should see the state of her, Evelyn. A right bloody mess she is. Set myself a challenge, there I have. Mind you, you've got to feel sorry for the lass. I mean, 7 bleeming kids and another one on the way. If I was there, I'd make my husband tie a knot in it, I really would. Either that or chop the dumb thing off."
She flashed me a look.
"Ooh, I suppose I shouldn't go saying such things in front of such tender young ears, should I?"
I rolled my eyes toward the ceiling. I hated it when adults pretended they felt some sort of obligation to censor themselves in front of me. At least I was past the age when they thought that spelling things out would leave me bewildered.
"Ooh, I don't care," Mabel said, waving a thick ribbon of cigarette smoke in front of her face. "You're going to have to learn sooner or later that all men are bastards, ain't she, Evelyn? I mean, I should know. I've been out with more of them than I care to mention. And not one of them was what I considered marriage material. Mind you," she said, slapping her pink, plump hand down on the table, "I might have been better off if I'd ruled out the ones that was married already."
She laughed, throwing her head back so I could see the rows of grey fillings in her back teeth.
"Oh, you are terrible, you, Mabel," my mother said, darting her tongue over her crinkled lips. "And you're right. You shouldn't go saying such things in front of Jessie. You know how easily influenced young girls are."
I rolled my eyes again. "Mum," I protested, wanting to suggest that if she was so concerned about the influences in my life, she might try exerting a few more positive ones herself.
"Oh, don't you worry, Ev. Our Jessie's a sensible lass, aren't you, love? And when she gets married, I'm sure..."
"I'm not getting married," I interrupted, "and I'm not having children." These were two things I was certain of. As far as I could tell, people who were married were never happy, and those who had children were downright miserable. My own parents were definitely a case in point. While my mother was probably the unhappiest person I knew, Auntie Mabel, unmarried, childless, and currently without what she referred to as a fella, was indefatigably cheerful. Though sometimes I had the feeling that even her cheeriness was forced, slapped on with the same overstatement as her shimmery blue eyeshadow.
"Of course you'll get married," Mabel said, swatting the air dismissively as I opened my mouth to protest. I expect even I'll take the plunge one of these days. Just got to find the right man. Rich, stupid, and just about to kick the bucket. She barked out another laugh, then took a puff of her cigarette before leaning across the table to crush the lipstick-ringed butt. As she bent forward, I could see down the front of her dress, the deep slit of her cleavage and the massive pale mounds of her breasts spilling over the top of her pink, lacy bra. Her whole chest was like two well-stuffed cushions, and I found myself thinking how nice it would be to rest my head there. "Everybody gets married in the end," she concluded.
That was Elaine Beale reading from her novel, Another Life Altogether. If you enjoyed that excerpt, you can hear Elaine read a bit more at the San Francisco Main Library on Thursday, July 15th at 6 p.m. You can buy the book and find out about Elaine's upcoming writing workshops at her website, elainebeale.com. She does have a workshop coming up this Saturday, which still has a few spaces. And of course, we will have those links on our website, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com.